Okay, today is August 24th, 2012. This is the third interview with Ron Schuler. We're here inside Steenbach Memorial Library, inside the UW-Madison Archives. My name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Madison Archives. Ron, for recording level purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Ron Schuler, S-C-H-U-L-E-R.
Great. So first off, Ron, I want to talk a little bit about these two. We took a couple of pictures here. These two, they look like magazines, or I think you talked a little bit about them at the end of.
Yeah, they are curriculum, Forest Small Engine curriculum, where there are three books for different age groups. Crank It Up, Warm It Up, Tune It Up, and they're basically I forget the actual age group, but like grade school, middle school, and high school ages. And that's a national 4-H material curriculum that's available. And in fact, I went on their website, and it's, although this was done in 2005, they're still available at the National 4-H curriculum library, or where they market these materials for 4-H projects, different projects. And so small engines happens to be one of them.
Okay. And did you... Again, you might have mentioned this at the end of the last interview, but I didn't get to review the last interview. How did you create those? Was that all you, or was that
It was a committee, and I was the lead person on the committee. I organized it, and there were maybe about 15, 20 people that were on the committee that was doing it, and then we had a writer, and other people that were experts also used some 4-H youth, some of the 4-H youth that I had worked with.
Okay. We
also reviewed the materials and served as for pictures, picture purposes, photographs as well.
Okay. And the reason why we took the picture of the one that's in the frame is because that is, it's your daughter and your granddaughter?
Correct.
Okay.
Right.
And then we also took a picture, because they're also in the Level 3 book.
Right,
picture,
and they're in some of the other books, too, which at least their granddaughter is.
Okay.
In fact, in one place, the two of them are there. One is dressed properly for safety purposes for lawn mowing. The other one isn't. They're like wearing sandals versus shoes and long pants.
Okay. I believe when we last left off, we'd got you back here to Madison in your job here, and that was in 1984. It says here in your resume that the job was extension and research.
Correct.
So, and I think I may have asked this at the end of the last one, but I'll ask anyway to start off. Was there teaching involved in that job?
Very little. If I did any teaching, I was kind of filling in for somebody who maybe was gone, or somebody had left, or just there wasn't somebody available to teach a class, so now and then I taught a class.
And
it wasn't part of my responsibilities.
And at that point in your career, were you fine with sort of making teaching less of a, or at least the classroom teaching less of a?
Right, because of extension, I've done some extension work, just doing research at other institutions. You have to get the research out to the people who use it, so I would look forward to actually doing that in Wisconsin, since it was my home state. Mm-hmm. I knew the geography of it, as well as I knew a number of people who were out and around the state I would run into at those meetings, including relatives.
Right. So how did the percentages go between extension and other things?
It was about three-quarters, one-quarter. And sometimes it was kind of an odd number, because it had to make the books balance in the department. So it might have been 76.5 or 76.45 or something like that.
So was it three quarters extension?
Right.
Okay. So you had been at Platteville, and you knew the folks here in Madison for the most part, from what you've said.
Right.
What sort of, were there big projects that you immediately jumped into, or what sort of things did you do when you initially got back here?
Actually, I started a little bit of research at Platteville, although it wasn't my assignment, but we could pick up some research on a project working with people in Madison here, It was a consortium project within the state, so where the Madison campus worked with one of the outlying campuses, whether it was Platteville, River Falls, or Stevens Point. And I had a project going when I was there on soil compaction. And so I was doing some work there already. So, and my collaborator was here on the Madison campus. And we continued some of that work, and so I continued working in soil compaction and also some tillage work. I started some tillage projects after I got up here.
Could you talk a little bit more about soil compaction, what it is and what your research specifically was looking at?
Actually, what we were looking at was there's a lot of wheel traffic on soil compaction and what that impact was on plant growth and also on the soil properties. So we would evaluate soil strength. We'd have plots, we'd get yields, obtain yields. And it was, in fact, I remember we having a project at Lancaster, at the research station at Lancaster, where we had some alfalfa plots that we had compacted. And we were looking at deep compaction as opposed to surface compaction. So usually we would compact it with a heavy machine and then till the top maybe like 8 inches, and the soil below was still compacted. And we could sense that. Our concern was how long does that compaction remain and how long does it affect the yields? And it affected the yields early on, but then later on it didn't have so much effect. What was unusual about it is that, although I don't know how we never really evaluated scientifically, was that we established alfalfa, and then where it was compacted, alfalfa came out pretty clean, no weeds. But where it wasn't compacted, a lot of weeds came up with the alfalfa, but later on, the alfalfa took over in succeeding years, but that first year. And that happened there, and we had a study on my brother's farm, on our family farm. We had a similar study, and the same sort of thing happened there as well. So so we were doing that work.
Sure. You said you didn't publish on that. That was just something anecdotally that you noticed.
The weed part of it, but yeah. We did publish the soil compaction work in terms of how long it remained in the soil. Usually 2 or 3 years it was still in the soil that we could sense it by measuring soil strength. Mm-hmm. We would do it with what's called a cone penetrometer, push a soil metal cone in the ground and measure the force to push it through the soil. And then we could get a measurement of the soil strength.
Mm-hmm. So quite different from when you were pushing the cherry pits back when you were breaking the cherry skin. Or trying to push the pits out?
Right, measuring the force there, yeah.
Did you do any other soil compaction other than the alfalfa studies?
Later on, I got a support from the potato growers, and I had two projects up at Hancock on potatoes where we did soil compaction work. And we did rotation corn and soybeans. Corn and potatoes, corn and potatoes. And so I had two different studies there, but one completed one, then I started another one.
And was this the same deep compaction?
Right, yeah.
Okay.
So then I also had one at in the Madison area, West Madison Ag Research Station. I had some plots out there where we compacted it, but we also did some different tillage practices on. Was primarily corn. Grew corn there. Continuous corn.
Okay. And with all of these projects, did you publish?
Yeah, we had some publications published in Mangere Society of Ag Engineering, presented papers at their meetings.
Were these I mean, the presentations obviously are one thing. Were these publications, were they large research?
They were just short articles in transactions or something like that, of maybe like a 3 or 4 page article that was, and it was all research-based articles in that publication, in the transactions, what it's called. And so.
Okay. And were you a co-author on most of these? Were you an individual author?
Usually co-author.
Usually co-author.
Okay. Yeah.
can't remember if we asked this last time. How did you and your family adjust to life back in? Actually, you know, we answered that. That's mm-hmm. been asked and answered about transitioning back into life in Madison.
Yeah.
So there was no teaching, unless you were filling in. Did you teach in the short course early on?
There I was filling in too.
Okay.
So
it wasn't an official position teaching in the short course.
Correct.
Okay.
No.
When did your work start with Farm Technology Days? Did that come much later in the?
No, it started right away.
Okay.
In 84 when I came here. That was part of the position description was to work with field demonstrations at Wisconsin Farm Technology Days. It was kind of always tied with this position, although there's only been one other person in that position since the show started.
Well, let's talk about Farm Technology Days then. Let's spend the rest of our time, or at least a good chunk of our time, talking about that. Because you had known about Farm Tech. You told a couple of cute little anecdotes before we even put the recorder on at your office about.
Right.
So I wonder if you could talk about even your knowledge of Farm Technology Days before you became directly involved in 84.
Okay. The show started in 54, I guess. And it was evolved from a plowing contest. And so a major part of the event was a plowing contest. And at the time it started, Dean Henry Algren, who was later became Chancellor of Extension, came up with the idea of having this to take the research out to the users. And but anyhow, they had a plowing contest with that. And my brother won the plowing contest. Although I was not at the show, I was well aware of the event, and I had heard about it, and didn't get to go again until I was at Platteville. I went to a couple of the shows, so at least I saw the show and was a little bit involved there as well. But I think it was the shows in 82 and 83 that I had gone to at least for a day, and then it was 84 when I had the responsibilities with regard to field demonstrations, always so that we had continuity from one year to the next. The show moves from county to county, or mm-hmm. a different county each year, and volunteers do most of the work, maybe all the work, but to provide consistency from one year to the next and to ensure we had a safe field demonstrations. The person in my position usually worked very closely and quite often had our state safety specialist involved too at that time.
So can you talk a little bit, or would you talk a little bit about these, specifically about these field demonstrations? What were some examples of them?
Oh, well, basically when I started, we had summer shows and fall shows. Summer shows focused on harvesting alfalfa for silage, for dry hay, and then it was a matter of mowing or cutting the forage, raking it, and then either chopping it for the forage harvest or baling it, and then of course storage as well. And then later on we got more into what the summer shows with bale handling. Large bales came in during that time, mm-hmm. large round bales and large square bales. And then the bales were normally for dry hay, but then later on they became, we harvested them for silage too. So when they were silage, they had to be wrapped. So we had plastic demonstrations wrapping the bales either individually or in a tube. And then the fall shows were tied in with the corn crop. Yeah. We were combining corn. We were harvesting corn for silage. We had the same harvesters basically. For harvesting, in terms of chopping them, and we may even do some baling of stalks. But and then we had tillage. Tillage was always a big interest. I think when we had as high as, I think one year I remember counting 17 different machines out in the field that were doing tillage. So different manufacturers, and some manufacturers had more than one, maybe different models. Always, but they're none were the same.
Since we don't know who will listen to this, I want to talk more about Farm Technology Days, but I think this is part of it, the difference between silage and tillage.
Oh, well, silage, we're taking corn, in terms of corn silage, we harvest a whole plant and cut it up into short lengths, usually about 3/4 inch. And that is cut, blown into a wagon or some sort of a box, and then put into a silo, either an upright silo, the round silos we see out in the countryside, or they're put in horizontal silos, or now they're also putting them in bags. But anyhow, it needs to be packed, and then it ferments, and it produces lactic acid for preservation, so it preserves it. And tillage, we're tilling up the soil. After we harvest the corn, we till the soil, break it up, and so that it's just a step before planting for the next spring of the year. Mm-hmm. So usually those shows were either in September or October, the fall shows.
And did the fall shows, do fall shows still go, or are they?
We discontinued those a couple of years ago. I think 2007 was the last fall show that we had.
What was the reason for that?
Part was, the feeling was the weather wasn't as good in September, October. Also, it was a crowded time for farm shows. Since then, some have changed, but we have several other major farm activities in the state. We have World Dairy Expo. We have, there's other shows, like there's a big show in Nebraska, Husker Days. Farm Review in Ohio, it's a big farm show. So it kind of divides where the companies go. And then there was a Farm Progress show, which was about that time, but now they moved it up earlier in September. But usually with that many shows at that time, it made it difficult for some of the companies to exhibit all the shows and have enough staff to get to all the shows. So that was one of the reasons.
So did you say that there was a Farm Progress show, or is here there's a Farm Progress show?
Farm Progress show is a show that takes place in Iowa, Boone, Iowa, and Decatur, Illinois. They switch back and forth between those. And it used to be three locations. There was a location in Indiana. They used to rotate between three states. Now it's just two states. And it's a three-day show, much like ours. And they have field demonstrations. They have exhibits. And we have, just to get the idea of the number, we have nearly 600 commercial exhibits at that show, at our show. And so it takes about, we always plan for about 60 acres of exhibits and displays. Wow. So, and then in addition to that, we have some education where we tend to feel ours is a little bit different, that we have focused more on education in our show. We have quite a large number of extension faculty and staff there. They're county level. Also state level, a lot of specialists from the UW-Madison campus are there. And we have basically two large tents devoted to research-related activities or other outreach activities that Extension is involved in. So, as well as there's a few outdoor displays.
Okay. I'd like to ask about either your first one, the one in 1984, maybe just a general question about the early ones. So how was do you recall your time invested, particularly as it got close to the event and then the event itself and maybe even after the event? What sort of things were you doing as it got close to D-Day, if you will, and then the event and post-event?
Okay. Basically, what I was the communication between the county and the companies that are demonstrating. So usually my role was to work with the county and identify what field demonstrations we would do specifically. And we had to work in conjunction with the farmer in terms of what he or she wanted. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't want to give them some large round bales when they didn't have the machinery to handle it, or then it wasn't in their program. So it was to do that, and then I would contact the companies based on the ones that had displayed. One of the requirements is that those that demonstrate don't have to pay, but they have to be exhibitors. So then I would send letters inviting them to demonstrate and list the machinery that we were demonstrating, and then they would return that to me, and And I would keep track of what machines we had, and if there were some demonstrations where there wasn't any interest, we would not do the demonstration. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so then I would meet with the county people and work out detailed demonstrations, also provide training. One of the things we want to be sure that we're safe, and we want to run them in a safe manner and keep people away. They want to stand up very close and watch the machine go by, and sometimes they look like they're almost running over their feet with they're standing so close. But we have some new machines that kind of throw crap out the back when they're cutting and mowing, that we want to further back. So we have, like I say, safety demonstrations, then also the process procedure for doing the demonstrations, because if we wanted to, we like to set aside 250 acres for field demonstrations. We could probably do that in a half a day with all the machines we have, but we want to spread it out and do it in a manner that people can see the machines operating. And mm-hmm. one of the benefits of field demonstrations, they see machines operating side by side in the same condition, field condition, in terms of crop yield, crop condition, crop moisture, or what have you, that it would impact the performance of a machine. So that's one of the advantages of doing the field demonstration. You see them side by side operate. And of course, now we have some huge machines out there, and some companies like to demonstrate how much capacity they have by how fast they can go. And we kind of restrict how fast they can go. So, mm-hmm. But sometimes at the end of the day, when we don't have many people out there, it's fun to watch them go. They go pretty doggone fast.
Mm-hmm, I bet.
So, in fact, the one will tease it out. I saw one day they're out there, and one machine was quite much larger than the other one. This big machine would take off, leave the other one behind, and then it would wait until the other machine caught up, and then it would take off again. Kind of like, you know, kids teasing each other.
Right. Like the big brother teasing the little brother about
right.
how fast or slow he can run. And so, what did you learn those first couple years? I mean, you'd seen it as sort of a mm-hmm. an interested individual in 82 and 83. What did you learn those first couple years, those first few years, about the procedure that you didn't know, or just sort of surprised you? Or
well, it was a matter of getting to know the people in terms of what they're and who could help, because there were some of the company people who would really go out of their way and help. Mm-hmm. There was, in fact, when I got through doing it in 2007. In fact, he's still there yet. From one company, was always helped out in the field a lot, and he was there. He was involved before I got involved in '84, and he still comes out and he helps, because sometimes it gets kind of complicated when we want machines to operate one behind the other. But I think was knowing, getting to know the people, and getting to understand the company people, understand the volunteers, although most of the volunteers are farmers, so I mean, I grew up on a farm, so I can, but nonetheless, getting to know people and the challenge of working with different personalities out there, and sometimes people were upset in terms of how we did things,
you alluded to this directly. I mean, that obviously when you came in '84. The 84 event, well, actually, you came in May of 84, so the 84 event was coming up fairly quickly.
Actually, there was an interim person between myself and my predecessor who picked up a couple of the shows, and I was actually his assistant that first year, so I wasn't really fully in charge by myself, but I was kind of his assistant. Then the following year in 85, he was my assistant.
Okay.
And then I started, then usually there was always, they always had the person in my position always had an assistant, and I did that for a while, and I've kind of gone away from it because I relied more on the volunteers, and some of the volunteers were not all farmers. Some had experience working with some of the volunteers, but were company people, maybe a local dealer, quite often. So they probably had a better understanding. I relied on them more mm-hmm. than having an assistant, and so that seemed to work out all right. So,
okay. What about choosing the location? I mean, it sounds like it might have been 1986 was your first year that you were, you know, sort of full blown in charge. At that point, Is the location chosen by sort of a larger group, and do you have input into that? How does that all work to figure out who's going to host it?
Basically, the whole show is run by a board of directors, Farm Technology Days. And I serve as the general manager now in my current position. I'm general manager of the show. So, but the board of directors is the one, they set the guidelines and select the county. Counties apply to host it. Mm-hmm. So we select the county first. And then once we select the county has to put together a committee. We call an executive committee of about 14 people. And they are the local organization or committee that runs the show in the county. And then they go through the process of inviting applications for farmers to host it, and they select the farmer, the host farm or farms, and usually with input from the state board. And in my position back then, I would go on to some of those trips visiting farms, because what we do is they get applications, and then they would be set aside where we would visit the farms to see what the farms are like, also to meet the farmers themselves, because one of the important factors that goes into it is not just the farmland, the type of farm, but also the farmers themselves. You know, how well are they accepted in the community? How well they get along with the neighbors, and how are they active in extension, or have they utilized extension? So those are some of the questions we look at, as well as at the individual farm. Another important factor is access, road access, mm-hmm. highway access. Mm-hmm. If you don't have good highway access, we can't get people in and out. And we had a sidebar this year. We had some major issues with parking and getting people in and out. And that's always a challenge, because when you have 20,000 to 25,000 people in a location, it's never, one day, that's always kind of challenging to get them all in and get them out in a very timely fashion.
Right.
Some people aren't willing to wait very long.
Right.
In line.
Is that what some of the issues were? Was the fact that it was tough to get in and get out?
This year it was, yes. Some years, usually it's a little bit of an issue in some years, but this year it was more of an issue because they limited the access we had. So you have to work with quite a wide range of people. You got the law enforcement to work with, you got the parking, what parking is available, and some of the layout of the land, and the law enforcement people put some major restrictions on that probably, in hindsight, should have been reconsidered. Mm-hmm. But it was getting people in and out. You need probably 3 or 4 entrances and exits to the parking. And one way to do that is have parking in 2 different locations and coming in from different roads. But here, this year, we had one large parking lot. Mm-hmm. And everybody went into that, all the visitors went into that one parking lot. So that, and we had 2 entrances, which wasn't probably enough. And one day we only had one entrance out, and that backed up the people. Mm-hmm. And some people were very irate.
Yeah.
That's one of the things with social media and so forth. The word gets back very quickly.
So maybe to talk a little bit more about these current events, so 2012, is this, was 2012, was this your last one?
I'm
going to
do one
man?
More.
You do one more?
In 2013. So just a sidebar, I'd like to also talk about a little bit of the research I did later on.
Sure.
That we haven't talked about, but we can finish up this Farm Technology Days first.
All right, so we want to talk some more about research.
Okay.
Let me circle that. Okay. So why this year, or I should say now next year, 2013, why is that a good time to hang it up?
Age? I'll be 72 next year. Well, I'll be 72 this year yet. Mm-hmm. So I think it's time to take a break from it. And quit work officially.
Does it, I know the answer to this, but I'll ask it. It must it must take some type of sort of mental and or physical toll preparing for and then being there and then, you know, when things go wrong, having to sort of deal with the after effects. Is that?
Yeah, there is. There's some stress there. Is the one of the things that happens is the state board of directors sets policies, and one of my roles is to inform the county of those policies and ensure that they follow those policies. And they always want to do something different. I'll say this, to me, that sometimes they always want to do something different. Sometimes they want to do some things that they think are new, but they've been tried before. Mm-hmm. You know, they do it, it's a once in a lifetime for many of them. And, some ways, I shouldn't equate them to about a teenager, in other words, always wanting to do things and think they've come up with a new idea, and usually it's not a new idea, or people have tried it in the past and it hasn't worked very well. And so consequently, I'm kind of the person in the room that has to say no to some of the things that they're doing, and it's not very, they're not very accepting of it.
So you've been doing this now for, well, almost 30 years.
Well, I was doing the field demonstrations that long, but then the
general manager.
General manager is just my third show.
Okay.
See, in terms of my role before, I was always out in the field. I never had to deal with the 60 acres of Tent City and the exhibitors, and because that's another aspect. Because some people get some exhibitors get a little bit irate too. Just an example, on Thursday morning of the show this year, I was told, go down to Tent A. Tent is a big tent. There's a conflict down there. Take care of it.
So no explanation as to what that conflict is about.
No. So I went down there to find out. It wasn't too bad, but I have to deal with the complaints. You know, like last year was, and this year too, but I didn't hear about it, but there was some company had a band playing. It was playing quite loud so that people nearby couldn't talk to their customers. So I had to go out there and tell them to turn the band down, you know. So it's some of those unpleasant things like that kind of.
So there's a lot more. I mean, besides the fact that you're now, you know, older than you were in the 80s and 90s,
right.
But there's also a difference between being in the field and having
right.
a sort of a narrow focus is what's going on, and then having to deal with everything.
Yeah. Right. When I was in the field, I only had to deal with one committee. There was a field demonstration committee. Now I have to deal with all 13 or 14 committees. And they always, you know, always, like I say, there's always, we have some fairly detailed guidelines, but they always seem to, there's some days there's so many, they don't, I go over all of them, but they don't always remember them, and so I have to remind them of them.
Right.
And so it's, and usually we go over them over 2 years before the show, and then by the time the show comes around, that's when you utilize them, and so consequently, because the major thing I do is to re-inform them of the guidelines and policies of the state. And we have those policies, so there's consistency from one year to the next,
right.
So the exhibitors can expect the same thing. You at least know what to expect. Usually we have about 80% of the exhibitors are the same from year to year. About 20% are local that only, you know, come there, and then next county there's another set of local exhibitors.
So what were, maybe we'll take this two ways. What's some of your strongest memories, either positively or negatively, when you were working out in the field, being sort of in charge of field demonstration? What are some of the things that stand out in your mind?
I guess, just trying to think, sometimes the negative things come by. One day I got chewed out royally by somebody, happened a couple times. And the only thing about that one time, it was a company that was from my local area and from where I grew up, and I knew the president of the company, so I kind of went to them and shared my experience, and it was somebody who really didn't feel we were doing demonstrations right, and so And then there was another case where another company, a long-standing company, that didn't like how we were, the process we were doing, and I just let them talk. I didn't, a lot of times, there's no advantage of arguing back a lot because they got their mind set up. You're just going to inflame it more. But later on, somebody from that company came up and apologized, and shortly after that, that person was no longer with the company. So anyway, but those are something that stick in my mind. But I guess another one that sticks in my mind was one day at the show, we had machines that have a different cutting mechanism. It's more like your lawnmower, a rotary cutter. Mm-hmm. And they can go, one guy told me that theoretically they could go 20 miles an hour. But most fields you'd have trouble staying on the seat of the tractor with that speed. But they were complaining about this one guy who came from England with this machine. And he told me how to slow down. He said, well, it doesn't do well when it's going slow. I said, either slow down or you got to park it. I said, it's unsafe. Well, I came all the way from England to demonstrate this thing, so but he slowed down, but probably not as much as I wanted him to. But they, you know, that's one of the problems. These machines have such large capacity these days that they can go across the field very quickly. But then you've got people standing in the area; it's very unsafe. And so those are some of the things that stick out. I remember another case. Not a real pleasant, but it was in Dane County here in 1986, I remember that. And I just ran into the guy again, email-wise. We had a John Deere chopper, went in to chop some corn, and the machine stopped. It had a metal detector on it. So if there was metal in the crop, it would stop it. Well, when you have standing corn, there shouldn't be any metal in it. So he looked, cleaned it out, tried it again, he checked it again, and he said, he tried it again, and it stopped. He backed out, and he said, I'll check it one more time. And here was a helical piece of metal, steel, on an ear of corn. Somebody had put it on the ear of corn.
Hmm. Wow.
And if that would have gotten in a machine that didn't have a metal detector, it would have caused a great deal of damage. Hmm. So that was kind of
Yeah, you think someone did that nefariously?
Yes. Wow. It was in '86, and I don't know, economic things, times weren't well.
Wow.
That was, that's the only way it could have gotten on there, is somebody put it on there. Wow. So, but anyway, then another time, we happened to be the same guy, and we were before the show, and he was chopping alfalfa silage, chopping and blowing in a wagon. And he was pulling the wagon, and wagons, like cars, have tie rods. Mm-hmm. And the tie rod broke, and the wheel was at about a 45-degree angle. And he was driving along. He didn't notice it. And I had to stop him. It was creating a furrow in the field.
Right.
And the other ironic thing about it was, there was a Minnesota wagon, the running gear underneath. And a Minnesota wagon is built by prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if there's any reference to the quality that they were producing. But anyway, He didn't even notice it. He had such a big tractor on it. It didn't create that much of a load for the tractor, but he was just driving along. He didn't even, and you can't see real well all the way back there either from the tractor or any kind of machine between the wagon and the tractor. So that one kind of sticks out with me and I. So, but anyway, I happened to get an email from that guy. So that was kind of, I just want to stop and see him sometime. I'd like to anyway, but because. That was the other thing. Another thing has changed over the years. We always had the same people back year after year from the companies.
Mm.
And so they were very familiar with the operation. But now, except in one case, but a lot of the bigger companies, you don't have the same people every year, so you have to kind of retrain them.
Mm.
So that's a little bit different. Some of the main lines like Deere or New Holland or Case now, they had the same people back, so they knew what to expect in field demonstrations. But now, you got people are moving around more, and that's just, of course, our society is that way as well. So, but they're moving primarily within the company in those cases to different locations, and so it's a little bit different from that standpoint.
Mm-hmm. So what about in your now five and a half years as general manager? What are some of the things that stand out about your time leading the technology days?
Okay. Volunteers really work hard to make sure the show is a success. I have to give them credit. We say close to 1,500 volunteers, and they're not getting paid. There's some that run food stands get paid, but it's the organization gets paid. It's a charitable or a service club or a group, a church group. But I think it's meeting, getting to know the farmers. Some of the farmers are very enjoyable to be around and visit with them. Especially when you're at a show and they're a show and the farmers from the preceding years come by and look for you and make time. There's one that not even as general manager, my second show up in Winnebago County, I still see the guy come. He comes back and talks to me. He's getting quite senior now, but he always seems to stop and find me, I always enjoy talking to him. For the most part, they're very, they're selected because of their personality is willing to work in the community and be good friends, with everybody. And I know this next year, this couple, husband, wife, they have no children but have a large farm, good sized farm. They're both very active on committees. A lot of times, the farmers are very busy with their own work and don't serve on committees. But here, it's a little bit different. The wife is involved in the food committee. Quite often, she prepares food for the food committee meetings. So if you want to join the food committee, there's always usually food there, yes. Mm-hmm. But then the husband, of course, is involved in the field demonstrations, and they're pretty, seem to take a little more active role than what some of them in the past have. But they're all really down to earth people, and I grew up on a farm, so I kind of feel I can relate to them.
Right. Well, and it sounds like there's a pretty substantial vetting process to finally get to the farm in the county to host the technology days.
So, right. Yeah.
If you've all done your homework, then at least that part of it, you should have a good farm and good farmers to work
right,
with.
Right. Yeah. We also, the one thing we do is we check the financial situation too, and usually, and it's not that we want to find out what the situation is, but all we want to do is have somebody look at the financial situation, and usually we have a banker on our committee, on the county committee, and it's a thumbs up or thumbs down. Usually it's always thumbs up. Most people know. Many people on our local, they usually know something about the farm already.
Mm. Right. So again, you may find out about that in the vetting process a little bit. Okay, so before we get back to this research question you want to talk about, is there anything else on your mind you want to talk about farm technology? Well, I know what I want to talk about, the pamphlets. I have a few here. These are great, pamphlets that you all have created.
Oh, I see. Okay,
So you gave me the last three.
Okay.
So is this something that's always been a part of Farm Technology Days, the idea of having these pamphlets to advertise it, in this case, over a year in advance?
Right. I'm not sure when it started. It started before my, I'm not sure exactly how many years they've been doing it, but the county does some things and the state does some things. The state takes care of this in terms of having it designed, and we usually have it needed out a year ahead, because before the preceding show, because we want the exhibitors to start signing up to exhibit at that show. So at the 2012 show, Barron County had people there, and they had applications for exhibitors to sign up.
Okay.
And so they were handing them out and taking the brochure out, and they went out and visited every exhibitor at the show and gave them a bag of materials. I don't even know what was in the materials, but I know there was a voucher for some ice cream or something.
Mm-hmm.
But But there's other things such as maybe motels in the area. I'm quite sure they had a Barron County has a nice brochure or booklet type thing that describes the county. I'm sure that was in there. Mm-hmm. So there's a number of things kind of, you know, informing them of the local locale or the local communities, okay. What towns are nearby. So so we need to get that out over a year ahead. So
okay. All right. So this is something that. How much, I guess I'll ask directly, how much input do you have in the pamphlet itself?
Quite a bit.
Okay.
I'm the one, we take it to a printer and a layout person, and I'm the final say of what goes in. And I ask, make sure they give us the pictures and try to get pictures that we can put in there. So, for example, Portage County, which is, almost 2 years away, they're gathering pictures, they're ready. Of the host farmers, and but anyway, it's my, but I do have the county provide me information. I mean, I don't get all the information. For example, there's a section on the county that describes the county, what kind of agriculture is in the county, also what kinds of things they're going to focus on, and UW Extension is going to focus on. Mm-hmm. They provide that, and mm-hmm. show features, things like that. I kind of suggest how the layout would be like, so it's kind of standard. We'd like to have a picture of the family or something, and you'll see in Outagamie County they didn't. It's got a group; they don't have a picture.
Right. So, last month's the front picture doesn't have the family.
Yeah, the families are inside.
Oh, okay.
So.
But usually you like to have a picture of the host family on the front part of the pamphlet.
I like to make it, at least since I've been involved, I think people like people pictures.
Mm-hmm.
People pictures on the front page.
Right.
Make it a little more interesting, I think. And more, my predecessor had a lot of exhibit displays with not people in them. I tend to put more people in the pictures. So.
Okay. Well, one more thing about Farm Technology Days, and that's the I'm going to say it, the toy that you showed me when we were the pre-interview.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the history behind folks getting a toy tractor or a toy?
Usually a toy is selected every year and only 1,000 can be made. And the county selects it based on some of the maybe the farmer could have some input into it, or something unique in the county. I can cite an example. In the 50 year, it was back in Waupaca County, which was where the first show was. The toy was an Oliver 77 tractor, which may not mean anything to most people, but and threw out and plow. What's unique about that was the tractor and plow my brother plowed with.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And that was the model, and he also found the plow that he plowed with and couldn't find the tractor. With this one in Outagamie County, it was a Fox chopper, harvest corn silage or hay silage. That was unique in several respects. One, the manufacturer was located, this isn't the manufacturer anymore, but was located in Appleton, which is the county seat. And it also had another connection with the university in that some of the initial research was done here in the Agricultural Engineering Department. Floyd Duffy, who was the one that did it, and I actually knew Floyd Duffy, and the research was done in the 1920s. They did the research 26, 27. And they took the information, and the Fox Tractor Company in Appleton took a lot of the information from his research and started building them. He actually had one built for himself by another farm machinery company, J.I. Case. They only built that one. It was for him to do research. He had kind of given them design requirements, and then he, like I said, did the research, and he worked with the people that were with the Fox Tractor Company at that time and started building the pull type. They had a self-propelled model, which came out in the 60s, I believe, 60s. So the initial one, the first one came out in 1936, I think it was the first. One that was manufactured over here. sold in 1932.
Oh, okay.
When they first started selling, they were the first ones to start selling that particular type of machine. Now all of them have, I mean, the major, John Deere and all those have this machine manufactured. And the basic design that Floyd Duffy worked with is still the design that's used today in terms of the cutter mechanism, how it cuts it up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and
I might also indicate there's a historical marker on campus commemorating this. And there's also one in Appleton as well from the American Society of Agricultural Engineers.
Do you know where the historic marker here is?
It's right on the front of our Ag Engineering Laboratory on the corner, just right down the street here on the corner of Elm Drive and Observatory Drive. It's right on the outside.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention about Farm Technology Days? Anything on your mind that you want to get off?
I don't think so. I think we're pretty well through with that.
You said you had a question about, or not question, you want to talk about some research.
Yeah, I followed up with some other research. I started, my extension work started going into precision ag toward middle, in the late 90s and into early 2000. Precision ag came in, and my extension work involved precision ag and telling farmers about precision ag, and now we got a lot of equipment that's, actually we got guidance systems for tractors to improve the productivity, where they don't even have to have their hands on the steering wheel. They'll just, using GPS, will guide the tractor and will be more accurate than the operator, especially when we have these wide machines. Sprayers can be as wide as 120 feet. And so I was, my research though focused on something a little bit unusual in that one of the things that we had satellites up in the air and a lot of aerospace type things was to start looking at an aerial view of a field, crop field. And I had several good sized fields, 60 acre fields that we were looking at. And what we're trying to do is relate what we saw in a infrared image to the yield, so we could kind of tell where the problems were, and it helped several ways. But we would fly, we got some data from satellite, we got some data by hiring planes to fly over, and they gave us images, and at different wavelengths, infrared and within infrared, different color range. And what we could do is see differences in the field early in the season, like once we got full what we call crop cover, when you saw all from the air, all you saw was green plants. Mm-hmm. And part of the idea was to maybe take corrective action if needed. But one of the things we find out, the most variability, I might back up, in the 60 acre fields, we had grain combines that the farmers had that had yield monitors on. So we know what the yield was like every, let's say 15 feet of the machine, operation of the machine. So every 15 feet by the width, then we had yield. And so we could see the yield variation within the field. We were trying to relate that to the images we had. So, but one of the other advantages I had was that if a lot of farmers have crop consultants or they do the scouting themselves. So if you walk into a field, like a 60 acre field, and you have this image, if the field is uniform, you just have to walk in one place. If there's variability in a field, and let's say one half of the field has a different color than the other half, mm-hmm. well, you just have to go in one half and then the other half one spot. You don't have to walk back and forth, which is what you end up doing when you don't have that imagery. So that's where it really would help crop scouting. But you could see problems ahead of time. Maybe you could even see some weed problems that maybe could be taken care of that you maybe didn't see right away, because mm-hmm. you could discern basically different crops out there actually would show up.
Okay. So,
and we would get images that we could look at meter by meter. In other words, we had, in fact, one of the planes had 120 different wavelengths, bands. So at each one square meter, we had 120 sets of data, plus the latitude and longitude of it, and the elevation. So that was, to me, that was kind of exciting, and I don't know how much it's taken off. I haven't really followed it real close since then, but I know there's some interest in doing more of that. And of course, we use a lot of satellite imagery in other arenas in terms of law enforcement or military operations and so forth. So that we got some pretty precise control, and of course, we got a lot of number of remote control planes flying, and not, in other words, we don't have to have the pilots flying out there getting shot down.
Did you publish on this stuff?
Yes, we did.
Okay. Yeah. Was it again smaller?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. And we actually had a multi-state project where we had support from the North Central Soybean Association. I was working with people in Missouri, Illinois, South Dakota, Michigan. And we were trying to, we were collecting data and comparing and sharing data as well, so that I wasn't the only one out there doing this.
So again, it was most of the work was co-authored with?
Yeah, right, with other people. Yeah.
Okay.
And I might also indicate one other thing I worked on, we tried to get a, was trying to measure variability in the field, and we worked on a moisture sensor, because one of the things that said moisture was a big variability, and in fact, there's some fields we were doing some studies on, and I drive by them, and there's always this one spot that was kind of higher gravelly knoll. Mm-hmm. There was always lower yields, especially in dry years, but in wet years, it'd be kind of turned around. But we did work on a device to try and sense moisture. It would have gone on a machine, but it was just the idea of sensing soil moisture on the go, pulling a tillage implement through the field, and we had a soil moisture sensor on it, and we were measuring that.
Was this research done around the same time as the Precision Ag stuff?
Yeah, this would be kind of part of Precision Ag. And,
okay.
And then actually another one we worked on, this one, we just had a paper on it, but we tried to, one of the things that you're doing now is a variable rate application. In other words, let's say you're planting corn and this high gravelly knoll is always kind of dry. Well, don't plant so many seeds there, but plant more where it's more likely to grow. But so a variable application, also looking at fertilizer, doing the same thing. And one that I think is successful is not fertilizer, but lime to correct for pH. Mm-hmm. You've got lime. Map of lime, you not all the same soil is the same pH throughout the field. But the one that we did work on was putting a load sensor on a manure tanker and try and apply manure at a variable rate. Mm-hmm. And there was some work done at Purdue too as well. But anyway, we had a weighing system that we worked with a company in Fort Atkinson on that, and they put a weight sensor in the tank, so we knew how fast, we could sense how fast it was unloading, that we could actually adjust the rate.
Right. And I assume you published on all this stuff too.
Right, there were papers on it.
Okay. We're at that magic hour mark.
So, oh, is that right?
Yeah. Is there anything else you have on your mind? Anything that's what we've talked about today has jogged your memory, and you want to make sure you get on the record before we...
I don't think so. I just think I've been lucky throughout my life to work in jobs that I enjoyed working at and meeting people that I enjoyed working with. You know, I was always, every morning I would look forward to going to work, and usually I was always one of the first ones in the office the department, whether I was chair at one time of the department, and quite often that's when you get a lot of work done, if you get there before anybody else does. But I've always been an early riser, and my wife too, but that kind of comes from growing up on a farm. We always were out in the barn like 4:30, 5 o'clock.
Right. Do you think you'll miss that retirement's still a year or so away, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Do you think you'll miss?
I think I'll miss it, but I'll be looking for other things to do. I've been looking at, I started pulling together a little bit of history of the department. We did celebrate 100 years some time ago, I think 2005, and a lot of departments have written histories, and I pulled some of it together, and I got a lot of historical items in my office. Some are publications, some are instruments, and I put together a little display, which needs more work on some of the historical things at the Defense Department.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's personal is a slide rule. I don't know if you know what a slide rule is.
I do know what a slide rule is.
So I put my slide rule in there.
I don't think I've seen a slide rule in a while, but.
Oh, is that right? Well, yeah. Come over there, you can see mine in the display case. And then I got some other sensing equipment, temperature sensors, surveying equipment that is very old.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ron, I want to thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.